All righty. Good morning, folks. Thank you, Brad. As executive director, it's important to understand where your board is, where they want to go, and I really enjoy working with Brad. He tells it like it is, lets you know where you stand, and we appreciate that. And, you know, as I'm talking about Brad, it's also true that no trade association can do its work unless it has members who actually say, okay, I'm going to devote a little bit of my time to work on industry issues, not just my own company's issues. And IRFA has been completely blessed in that way. I really think we've over the last years, have made a name for ourselves here in Iowa and throughout the country, throughout the Midwest, and that credit for that goes to the board. And so on behalf of the IRFA staff, I would just like to take this time to say thank you to Brad and to all the IRFA members and those that devote their time to the board. Speaking of the staff, I don't know if she's in the room, but I would be remiss if I didn't single out IRFA's Managing Director, Lucy Norton. This is Lucy's brainchild. This is Lucy's project. She makes it great. Every year we walk out of here thinking, wow, that was the best one ever, and it seems like every year she does it again. So, Lucy, thank you for all the work you do for the summit as well as all year round. And like me, the other IRFA staffer, Grant Minky, our biofuels manager, also helps a little bit with the summit. And in fact, he's in charge of one of my favorite parts. He does lots more than this, but the high school video contest. This is our second one, and I will just tell you, be back in here at 1 o'clock after lunch for when they show the winning videos, and I think some of the kids are actually going to be able to join us here today. In fact, the winning video this year just blew our doors off, and if we can't make it go viral, then they might as well shut down YouTube as far as I'm concerned. So it is a pleasure to be here today. In my line of work as an executive director, it's always best to put a happy face on your industry, more or less regardless of what's going on. And so last year I stood up here before you after 2010 and I smiled. But, you know, it was kind of like one of those smiles you might have seen if you watched the media coverage of the Iowa caucuses and the candidates up here speaking and their families off to the side, and they're always looking up with that smile frozen on their face no matter what the candidate might have just said that was stupid. And so it's kind of stuck there. And that was a little bit how I felt last year. But this year, I can tell you that the smiley face is genuine, and it's genuine to the core. 2011 was a good year for both ethanol and biodiesel industries. We saw record production. We saw a return to some profitability. And I even heard of a few dividends being paid. And in fact, when I was walking outside a little bit ago, I noticed that there were more than a few new pickups out there in the parking lot. So I think it's been a good year. I want to be sure to note that I'm not boasting or bragging. We're not being insensitive to our friends and neighbors that are out there looking for work. But as a farm boy who grew up during the 1980s farm crisis, I think it is important to celebrate the success of the renewable fuels industry and the profoundly positive impact that it's had on Iowa's economy and our rural communities. Now, no one's blind to the fact that we'd like Iowa's economy, and for that matter, the nation's economy, to be better. We're not satisfied. But neither should anyone question that Iowa has done better during this long recession than many other states. And the reason for that is our strong agricultural economy with renewable fuels leading the way. So let's get on to some review of the industry. In 2011, we had 41 ethanol plants with a capacity to produce 3.7 billion gallons. They chewed up a little over a billion bushels of Iowa corn. To put that in perspective, that'd be about 57% of the corn crop that we harvested this last fall. So in other words, more corn goes to Iowa ethanol plants than any other, more Iowa corn goes to Iowa ethanol plants than any other destination. And in fact, Iowa would be the third, think about this, Iowa would be the world's, if Iowa were a country, Iowa would be the world's third largest ethanol producer behind only the rest of the United States and Brazil. We would be number three if we were a country. So Iowa also has 13 biodiesel plants, and if they were all running, we could produce about 320 million gallons. Now, the lapse of the tax credit in 2010 really shut down a lot of these plants. We got that back in place in 2011, and we produced a record 169 million gallons with 10 plants operating in 2011. So we're very happy about that. But I think it's also important to note that a lot of those plants came online and ramped up production throughout the year. So by the end of the year, they were actually operating at an annualized rate of about 264 million gallons. So we're excited about that. So what's that mean for Iowa? Well, producing 3.7 billion gallons of ethanol and 264 million gallons of biodiesel takes quite a bit in the way of inputs and services. In fact, according to an economic study that we're releasing today, it takes just over $12 billion worth of inputs to do that. And so as a result, renewable fuels production at the rates realized at the end of 2011 accounts for about $6 billion of Iowa's GDP, or roughly 4% of Iowa's economy is tied directly to renewable fuels. It puts about $3.7 billion in the pockets of Iowa families, and it supports directly and indirectly, as all that activity trickles throughout the economy, about 82,000 jobs. Now, that's not too bad. So tonight, I'm sure you're all going to tune in, and you're going to hear the president give a report on the state of the union. Well, this morning, I can assure you that the state of the Iowa renewable fuels industry is revived and ready for continued success and ready for the challenges that lay ahead. Now, let's be honest, there are challenges. I know it's hard to believe, but not everybody in America is enjoying the renewable fuels success story. There are some who actually would prefer that we would go back to the days of $1.80 corn. There are some who actually preferred 99.9% dominance of oil in our fuel supplies. So we have some large grocery manufacturers or some national livestock groups that have quite frankly sought to demonize ethanol as the cause for food price inflation. And higher corn prices do have an impact, but it's a minuscule impact at the consumer level compared to the costs imposed by the higher energy prices. In fact, according to the updated food dollar chart from the USDA, it's just that sliver on the right, or excuse me, the left, my right, your left, that is spent on food that goes to all the different types of farmers. It's about 11.6 cents out of the dollar. That's all farmers. If you shave off just what goes to corn farmers and where they say the impact is, it's less than 3 cents. So we have a board member, Denny Mauser, who's fond of saying, "What in the world does the price of corn have to do with the price of bananas?" Well, obviously nothing. But the price of fuel does, because those bananas don't fly to the grocery store on the wings of eagles. We tried to find one, but they mostly go there via petroleum-driven transportation and processing and everything else. So it's important to understand that the cost of fuel impacts a family's budget in many ways, not just fueling up your car, but also impacting what you pay for a price of banana. And so when you understand that, it's important when you're looking at the impact of ethanol in the family budget, not just to look at what tiny little, almost insignificant impact it has on the price of food overall, but the price of fuel that you pay as well. And last year, right here in Iowa, at Iowa State University, they took a look at that. And they found that by using ethanol at the rates we do in 2010, so it'd be even better in 2011, we reduced the average gasoline price by 89 cents a gallon. This is nationwide, 89 cents a gallon. And in the Midwest, where we have an even greater concentration of the ethanol use, the savings were larger. Consumers in the Midwest averaged a savings of $1.37 per gallon. Those are pretty big numbers. You might be like, wow, that doesn't sound right. But it's not surprising if you think about it. I mean, ethanol now accounts for basically 10% of our fuel supply. If you took 10% of the fuel supply out of the market, it would have a major impact on fuel prices, and that's what we're seeing. So we need to be aware of that. So there is simply no doubt that the typical American family saves hundreds of dollars a year because of ethanol when you factor in not just food prices, but fuel prices as well. And that's an important fact that we need to repeat and repeat and repeat, because believe me, the other side is doing their best to get people to only look at half that equation. You know, and why is that? Why is that? Well, I think the heart of the opposition from the big food and the big livestock groups is the fact that they're looking at their profits. They're not concerned about your wallet. They're concerned about their wallet. So if you dig through, so I thought, well, let's look at this. If you dig through USDA databases, you come across an interesting fact. Now, I understand you can't see these numbers very well by the time I squeezed them all on here, but if you look down here and you go up to here, that is 1981 to 2005. And in that time, you'll see a lot of red over here. And in fact, in 22 out of 25 years during that time frame, the average national cost to produce a bushel of corn was higher than the average cost a farmer got when he sold that corn. It cost more to produce the corn than the farmer got in 22 out of 25 years. And you say, well, how is that sustainable? Well, before ethanol production ramped up, the taxpayers funded multi-billion dollar farm programs in order to keep the farmers in business. So think about that. If you grew corn here in Iowa at the cost back then of, let's say, $2.60 a bushel, and you fed it your own livestock, then you were at a huge disadvantage to the large feedlots in Texas, for example, because they were only paying about $2 for that same bushel of corn, but you had $2.60 in it. So our farmers here couldn't compete. And not surprisingly, we saw an important segment of value-added agriculture leave Iowa, leave the Midwest, and go to places like Texas, North Carolina, California, and so on. But to go back to that previous slide, if you look at the top here in the shaded area, that's after 2005. Not coincidentally, the year the first renewable fuel standard was signed into law, I might know. The average farm gate price for a bushel of corn since that time has been above the average cost to produce that bushel of corn. And as a result, we're seeing cattle numbers go back up in Iowa, and you're going to hear more on that in this afternoon's panel. So it's important to understand that ethanol is not bad for livestock, as some groups want you to believe. And in fact, speaking for a moment to my friends in Texas, and I have a couple still, I understand, so to my Texas friends, I understand that you don't like the change. I understand that you would prefer $1.80 corn, okay? But with all due respect, my dad never liked selling corn to you for less than it cost him to produce it. And the taxpayers never liked subsidizing your profits by supporting a farm bill as the only way to keep family farmers afloat. And that hardworking family farmer up here in Iowa didn't like making farming decisions based on a federal program instead of a fair market price for their product. So yes, ethanol has changed corn economics, but our country is the better for it. After 25 years, if that chart, you saw the red. After 25 years of having the farm bill subsidize the large livestock producers, like our friends down in Texas, I'm sorry, but they're just not going to find a lot of sympathy here for their vision of the future, which is to go back to $2 corn. That would be a recipe for disaster and, quite frankly, a recipe for subsistence farming. Now, the other line of attack that we're dealing with today comes from our good friends at Big Oil. Now, just to be clear, that's just a catchphrase. I want to differentiate. I'm talking about the large multinational corporations, not our friends here in Iowa, the jobbers and the retailers. So that's, for lack of a better term, I use Big Oil. So Big Oil has grudgingly accepted the reality of E10, basically universally across the country. But let me tell you, they have no intention of giving up any more market share without a fight. And in fact, over the last 12 months, we've seen Big Oil use every legislative, judicial, and regulatory trick in the books to slow the growth of ethanol and biodiesel. Just look at some of the Big Oil's actions over the last year. They sued the EPA to prevent the sale of E15 after the EPA approved it. They sued the EPA to roll back the 2011 federal biodiesel requirement in the RFS. They went to Congress, if you saw that picture, they're raising their hands. That's when they testified before Congress that they needed, it was necessary to keep their tax breaks, while at the same time, some of their members were writing letters to Congress urging the end of the renewable fuels tax incentives. A little hypocritical. Big Oil lobbied Congress, in fact, this is still a fight that's ongoing, to use an appropriations gimmick that would essentially ban E15 from entering the marketplace. So they wanted to ban the competition in Congress. Next slide. They used their monopoly power over distribution to prevent E15 from being sold in the summertime because they won't put the proper blend stock in the pipeline. They bar. You go to the contracts. Here in Iowa, all of our gas stations are independently owned, but some of them are branded with the Big Oil names that you're all familiar with. In those contracts, they often bar those retailers from selling higher level blends like E15 or E85 under the canopy, or listing those prices on the marquees, on the price signs. They've also urged EPA to adopt an absurdly anti-E15 mandatory pump label, but oh no, we wouldn't want to label when we tried to say, well, let's label the known human carcinogen level in petroleum fuels, because it varies depending on how they formulate that gasoline. Oh no, we wouldn't want to put that information out in front of consumers. And then finally, they also oppose country of origin labeling on gasoline, which denies you the power to go to the pump and say, hey, I'd like to buy gasoline that has a little more domestic renewable fuels or domestic oil or something like that, as opposed to maybe one that has more oil from, you know, Venezuela or Nigeria or Iran or other, you know, interesting vacation spots like that. So I could keep going on and on and on, but I'm going too long here. You get the picture. The fact of the matter is, big oil does not want free market competition. They do not want a level playing field. And when you look at the list, why would they? So today, think about this for a second. Today, the oil industry enjoys billions of dollars in tax subsidies, while the renewable fuels industry has none. Let's just look at this. Do we have the next slide up? Just a partial list. Actually, I don't have a slide for this. I'll read them off to you. Percentage depletion. These are things that are unique to the oil industry for tax credits. Percentage depletion allowance. Marginal oil well incentives. Enhanced oil recovery credits. Intangible. I'd like to write off my intangible costs. Intangible drilling costs expensing. Deduction for tertiary injectants. Apparently, primary and secondary weren't enough, so we have tertiary injectants. Exception from passive loss limitations for oil and gas excess percentage over cost depletion. I don't have a clue what half that was. In fact, you probably have to be a high-priced accountant to figure it out. But those are just a partial list of things that are unique to them, not even the other tax credits that are more broadly available that they take advantage of. So because that's a little confusing, let's see what other people say. DTN, very respected group. DTN reported that the state and federal tax and other incentives available exclusively to the oil industry adds up to about $17.9 billion annually. And there's a firm that goes out there and tries to put all these deals together called Western Capital Energy Development. And on their website, as they're trying to get these investors, they say the immediate deduction of intangible drilling costs is very significant because your risk capital is effectively subsidized by the government. Can't lose. And, you know, the Internet's the source of all knowledge, right? So I went to Investopedia.com, and this is a quote off their website. No other investment category in America can compete with the smorgasbord of tax breaks that are available to the oil and gas industry. Even on the American Petroleum Institute's own website, they note that, quote, taxpayers have had the option to expense intangible drilling costs since the inception of the tax code. As if somehow it's been around a long time, that makes it more legitimate. Folks, that's back to 1913. Isn't 100 years enough? I mean, when are they going to do what they should do and give those up instead of arguing they need them? And what's tough for us is they put those tax credits to good use. They've spent that 100 years building up a fuel distribution monopoly. They control the refineries, very small number of groups. So they control what goes in the pipeline, which means they control, they don't necessarily own all of them here in Iowa, but they can control what goes into these terminals, and what goes in the terminals is what's available down here for the retailer. So they can actually control what goes in a corner gasoline station oftentimes. And the impact of this monopoly is very real and very powerful. Consider this. Even when E15 clears all the mountain of federal regulations to become a legal fuel for the non-flexible fuel vehicles, the non-FFEs, big oil will still be able to freeze E15 out of entire markets for much of the year. In Iowa, we have consumers who want to buy E15. We have retailers who want to sell E15. But some of those retailers are branded by big oil, and so their contracts simply won't allow it. Okay, they decided to be a branded retailer, their contract won't allow it. Okay. I don't like it, but that's life. But big oil can even prevent E15 from being sold by independent retail stations in the summer. Now, I don't want to get too far in the weeds. This is a fairly technical issue. But due to some idiotic federal fuel regulations, in the winter, we can blend E15, 15% ethanol, with a type of gasoline, typically in Iowa, to blend with E10, and it meets all the specs. So we can sell E15 in the winter from, you know, roughly middle of September to May. But in the summer, they have different specs, and because of these federal regulations that don't match up, we will not be allowed to make E15 out of the same gasoline that we blend with E10. And guess what? Big Oil has told us that they have no intention of putting the gasoline in the pipeline to Iowa that is suitable for blending with E15. So in other words, if we don't have the blend stock, we can't make E15 in the summer, even if you want to buy it and the retailer wants to sell it. And now we're looking for ways to get around that distribution monopoly, but that's a tough nut to crack. And that's a clear example of big oil's fuel distribution monopoly in that it can prevent free market competition and thwart the will of the retailers and the consumers who want to use E15. Where in the world is the free market in that? But the biggest hurdle for renewable fuels energy security, the biggest hurdle for renewable fuels and energy security is an issue you may not have thought about. It's something I call the federal petroleum mandate. Now, if nothing else, leave here today understanding this, that the federal government mandates that the vast majority of fuel you buy be from petroleum. Let me repeat that, because you go to the gas station, most people don't think about this. The vast majority of fuel that you buy is mandated by the federal government to be from petroleum. Now, big oil is fond of labeling things like the renewable fuel standard as a mandate, but they don't like to look in the mirror as much. So how does this work? What is this federal petroleum mandate? Federal law requires that any fuel that goes that you put in your vehicle must first be approved by the EPA. Of course, when they set this system up, gasoline was grandfathered in. How convenient. So what happens if you put a non-approved fuel in your vehicle? You are subject to a federal fine of $37,000 a day. And after 20 years of this federal law, what are the currently available approved fuels? It's what we call, well, to be fair, if you're one of the 4% in America that drives an FFV, you do have more options. But for the other 96%, those approved fuels are what we call E0, no ethanol, and E10. But flip that around for a second. Think about it from the petroleum perspective. The approved fuels are 100% petroleum and 90% petroleum. And if you use something else, like you want to put E30 in your old 1999 Chevy pickup, I've never done it, you could be fined each day about the amount an average Iowan takes home after taxes for the entire year. Folks, that is a federal petroleum mandate, plain and simple. So let's look at that playing field. Let's have a comparison. Look over here. Billions in tax subsidies. Big oil, yes. Renewable fuels, no. Federal pipeline loan guarantees. Big oil, yes. Renewable fuels, no. In fact, this week alone, a project was shelved to take ethanol via pipeline from the Midwest to the New York Harbor because we don't have access to a federal loan guarantee to backstop that project. But if that same pipeline was going to carry petroleum, boom, it's got it. Fuel distribution monopoly. Big oil, yes. Renewable fuels, no. And the federal use mandate, the thing they like to throw in our face, big oil, 90%. The RFS is about 10% this year. Is that a level playing field? Federal policy is tilted completely in the favor of big oil. And we need to know about that. We need to understand it. We need to share that with our friends and neighbors because they do a very good job of focusing all your attention on the bottom right-hand box and ignoring all the rest of that. So what should we do? We should start by protecting the federal renewable fuel standard from the assault by big oil, big food, and big livestock. In the face of the federal petroleum mandate, combined with the massive federal tax breaks and tax subsidies for big oil, the RFS is the best tool, and almost the only tool we have, to help open the doors for ethanol and biodiesel. Now, whether through legislation or a waiver request, any unraveling of that RFS must go through the President of the United States. And for that reason, IRFA teamed up this year, over the last several months, with the National Renewable Fuels Association to create the Iowans Fueled with Pride Coalition. The coalition of Iowa renewable fuels producers was committed to providing accurate information to the public, to the media, and to candidates during the Iowa caucuses. And we worked to try to have a comprehensive and open debate about the future of energy policy. And quite frankly, I think it was a good success, a great success. On the Iowans Fueled with Pride website, if you go there, you'll find many video clips of candidates talking about energy policy and renewable fuels in their own words. And many of those are unique to our volunteers going out and getting them on camera. A compilation of these candidates' views on the important issues was mailed to roughly 10,000 Iowa households before the caucuses. And spare copies of that, by the way, are available at our booth in the trade show. Obviously, some of those candidates are no longer running, but in the fall, the people running for president are going to be listed with their positions in that voter guide. So I encourage you to pick one up in the booth and take it home. So by the time Iowans went to the precinct caucuses on January 3rd, those that got the first-class ticket, if you will, out of Iowa, President Obama, Governor Romney, and Senator Santorum, they had all publicly declared their support for the renewable fuel standard. And I should note now that Newt Gingrich has won South Carolina and back in the mix, that Newt Gingrich is also a strong supporter of the RFS. So I'm not really one to count chickens, but I'm fairly sure that no matter who is elected president this November, they will be a supporter of the RFS. And that is very, very important. And while I'm excited by that, it's not just the president who is important. Congress has an important role to play as well. And Congress should start by immediately reinstating the federal biodiesel blender's tax credit. It's true that the ethanol industry in 2011 became the first industry to ever voluntarily give up an existing tax credit. And given the maturity of the ethanol industry and the current federal budget situation, it was, quite frankly, the right thing to do. You think maybe Big Oil will follow suit? Yeah, don't hold your breath. However, biodiesel is different. It's in a much different spot. It is a much younger industry. And when you think back to those advantages that the oil industry receives, biodiesel needs the tax credit to continue building out its own blending infrastructure so we can get the product in front of consumers. And extending that biodiesel tax credit will ensure that there's time to do that. And biodiesel, if you think about this, why is that important? Biodiesel, there are a number of reasons, but one of them I want you to think about today in particular is biodiesel is currently the only alternative to petroleum in heavy-duty applications. And we're going to learn a little bit later how important that is, particularly to our military. The last time the federal government allowed the biodiesel tax credit to lapse, the industry just almost stopped in its tracks. In fact, in 2010, Iowa produced only 48 million gallons of biodiesel. That was a 60% reduction from the previous year and way below what we were able to do this year. Now, it's unlikely that the current lapse is going to have the same level of impact, but it's instructive to kind of look at that today and compare it to what happened in the past. So we had the study we released today, the economic impact study, took a look at that. So what would happen if Iowa biodiesel production dropped 60% like it did the last time the blender's tax credit went away? Well, it would cost Iowa dearly. GDP would be reduced by over $200 million. Iowa families would lose more than $150 million of household income. And worst of all, roughly 3,200 Iowa jobs would disappear. We can avoid this. We don't have to take this blow to our economy. Everyone wants to get more jobs out there. Everyone wants more energy security. Congress needs to quickly reinstate the federal blender's tax credit for biodiesel. Now, on the ethanol side, the immediate challenge is to commercialize E15. 1 year ago this week, EPA approved E15 for use in vehicle model years 2001 and newer. Anyone buying it yet? Nah, we're still stuck in neutral. We're unable to sell E15 of those cars. Because while that approval was the first and biggest hurdle to clear, there are other regulatory requirements which have to be satisfied before E15 can be sold to the non-FFVs. I'm actually hopeful that we may learn very soon that the last hurdle, something called fuel registration, essentially the EPA saying, yeah, this is a healthy fuel, it's not going to kill people, has been cleared in the near future. Now, Iowa is prepared to be a leader in the adoption of E15. IRFA has worked with Iowa retailers over the last few years to get our laws and regulations ready for E15. In fact, IRFA and the Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Stores of Iowa recently formed a partnership to work on these issues as well as to educate retailers and the public about E15 and biodiesel as well. So last year, Iowa legislators and Governor Branstad approved some landmark legislation for E15. The Senate File 531. It created the nation's first retailer misfueling liability protection for E15, and it also created the first E15 retailer tax credit. And this year, we're talking about hopefully opening up Iowa's existing renewable fuels infrastructure grant program for E15 pumps and upgrades, in addition to the E85 and blender pumps that it's already qualified. Now, once the EPA gives us that green light, I am confident that Iowa will be the first state to sell E15 to non-FFVs. In fact, we've got about 20 retailers that right now today are selling E15, but currently you have to limit it to the FFVs only. And we have many other retailers that are eager to offer that E15 to consumers once they get the green light. Let's be honest. We're not going to change national ethanol demand by selling E15 in Iowa. But we will change national ethanol demand by proving to retailers and consumers all across this country that E15 is a preferred fuel choice. And if we can export that E15 retailing success story from Iowa, we can help unlock 7 billion gallons of demand, of additional ethanol demand that E15 represents. And so that's why Iowa is taking this so seriously. The long-term challenge for ethanol is to break through the federal petroleum mandate and the petroleum distribution monopoly that I talked about earlier to secure true consumer fuel choice. You know, I've said in past summits, I wish I could wave my magic wand and make every car an FFV and every pump a blender pump, and then you all could decide, and we'd be doing just fine. But promoting the production, unfortunately, I don't have a magic wand. Promoting the production of FFVs and incenting the installation of blender pumps should be a top priority for any federal energy bill. That would result in more competition, more free market competition, not less. But others try to say, oh, that's picking winners and losers. Well, the fact of the matter is, as Robert McFarlane wrote in the New York Times a while back, and I quote, doing nothing is equivalent to mandating a monopoly by a single fuel whose price is set by a foreign cartel. He goes on, competition is a bedrock of our American way of life, and it's time to introduce it into our fuel market. Folks, I could not agree more. The stakes could not be higher. As part of our caucus project, we produced a brochure entitled Ethanol and National Security, the quote of many leading experts. Copies of that brochure are also available next door in the IRFA booth, and I really encourage you to pick one up. Let me hit a few highlights. Ann Coren with the Set America Free Coalition states, every major national security problem we're facing has roots in oil. Where does the money come from for Iran to develop weapons of mass destruction? We're at war with an ideology, and that ideology is radical Islam, and we cannot win the war against radical Islam as long as we are funding the other side of the war. Former Secretary of State George Shultz noted, wealth transfers from oil have been used and continue to be used to fund terrorism and its ideological support. Estimates of the amount spent by the Saudis in the last 30 years spreading Wahhabi beliefs throughout the world vary from $70 billion to $100 billion. And former CIA Director Jim Woolsey adds, if you want to know who's paying for those madrasas in Pakistan or the West Bank to teach those little boys to hate, just the next time you go to a filling station, before you get out to charge your gasoline and take out your credit card, turn your rearview mirror just a few inches down so you're looking into your own eyes, and now you know who's paying for those little boys to be taught to hate. Those are strong words, but they're true words. And folks, big oil would have you believe that we're stuck, that we can't do anything about it, we can't make a meaningful impact. But that line of defeatism is big oil's most insidious and sadly effective weapon to attack alternative fuels like renewables. But don't believe it. If you can't fix it overnight, don't bother fixing it. Don't believe it. According to the Energy Information Administration, in 2005, when the first renewable fuel standard was signed into law, our net dependence on foreign oil peaked at just over 60%. However, by 2010, just 5 years after the RFS went into effect, our net dependence on foreign oil had dropped to under 50%, just under 50%. That's a 10-point drop in 5 years. And renewable fuels is actually cited as one of the top three reasons for why that happened. Now that's a 10% reduction. That's pretty good. But yes, there's a long ways to go. But to me, that's proof that meaningful improvements can be achieved in a relatively short order when government policy even slightly allows competition with big oil. So we must leave here today and demand an end to big oil favoritism. We must demand a level playing field for renewable fuels. We must demand consumer fuel choice and truly free competition. And we must demand it now. I mean, after all, think about this. Oil's $100 a barrel, and we're in a recession, or at least not quite out of it yet. Iran is threatening the Straits of Hormuz. And we're funding our enemies while soldiers die guarding supply convoys of petroleum in Afghanistan. Folks, America needs a wake-up call. You can do it. We got to start here. You've got friends, you've got coworkers, you've got church groups, you've got coffee buddies. So whether over that cup of coffee or around the water cooler, or maybe even while enjoying a beverage-grade ethanol drink, start that conversation now, and don't stop until the United States has a sensible energy policy. Too much is at stake to remain quiet. So enjoy today, learn today, but most importantly, leave here motivated and activated to take action. Thank you very much.